Tonight on Arena, The Eddie, Damien Chazelle's new Netflix drama set in a Parisian nightclub, and art in times of revolution. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Whether it's Samson in the Bible or Medusa in Greek myth, meaning and symbolism have long been attached to our hair, our crowning glory. A new exhibition of photographs has just opened online, exploring the subject in a more modern setting. Crown, Hair and Identity in Traveller Culture features a group of girls and women from Castlebar and Ballinrobe in County Mayo, and the portraits are the result of a collaborative project between these women, the artist Breda Mayock and photographer Orla Sloyne. Breda Mayock and Annie Lawrence, one of the women in the photos from the Mayo Traveller Support Group, join me now on the line from Mayo. Breda, to start with you, I suppose hair really has always been a very powerful symbol and has often figured in works of art. Where did this particular project start for you?
Hi, Sean. Yes, well, I've had a natural curiosity and admiration for hair adornment across all cultures. And I've always noticed traveller women's hair because of its length and the plaits and various styles, some of which can be very elaborate. So hair is a powerful symbol of individuality, and it's deeply linked to gender and identity and ethnicity. And Irish travellers are an ethnic minority group who have been part of Irish society for centuries. So as a visual artist, yeah, I'd be aware of the huge canon of work by artists on the subject of hair. So I think it's such an emotive subject because it's so closely associated with the human body. So we're straight into the area of body consciousness, and it spans culture and gender and race. You know, it's a powerful human raw material, and it's a great conveyor of stories and meanings and memories. So with this project, I got in touch with traveller girls and women to talk to them about their hair. And we've had lots of conversations, and hopefully we will have a lot more in the future.
Annie, then, you're a community health worker with Mayo Traveller Support Group. This is in Castlebar. And this was how you first met Breda and got involved in the project.
That's right, yeah. I'm a community health worker in the Mayo Traveller Support Group in Castlebar. And Breda got in touch with us by through our coordinator and organised, you know, to call in and to talk about the project. So when Breda came to us about the project, well, I was very interested and excited. I thought I would love to be part of, you know, the project. And with the project, we talked, you know, a lot about hair, and we went down memory lane. And also a lot of childhood, you know, funny memories. And as you know, it is travellers' tradition to take care of their hair. You know, travellers express themselves by their hair. I think it's very important to travellers how their hair looks, as it is part of our identity and culture. And as travellers are recognised, you know, by their long hair. You know, by the plaits and the long hair and the upstyles, and you know.
Yeah, in fact, I was looking at some of the pictures online today, and the first thing you notice is in the majority of cases of all of the women and girls who are photographed, it's the length of the hair. I know that your two teenage daughters, Kathleen and Martina, are pictured there. Are you pictured yourself within the pictures?
I am.
Which one is you?
It's the highlighted long hair. The waist length, anyway, down to the waist. That would be my pictures. But my two daughters, Caitlin and Martina. Two teenage girls. Do you know, myself and the two girls, do you know, it was lovely because we did it together. Do you know, we went to the Lennon Hall, and Orla and Breda were there. Do you know, Orla Sloyne, she's a photographer, she's great. And we really enjoyed it, you know, and we had great fun. And it was lovely expressing ourselves through our hair. As you know, the long hair is the tradition and the culture in the travelling community. And hair is a huge part of our identity. And it really is our crown and glory.
Well, I was thinking... I was thinking of one of my own, well, both my own sisters in their childhood had very long hair. And I remember a shampoo called No More Tears, No More Tangles.
Oh, now, I do as well. I remember that.
Yeah, I was looking at the length of, Caitlin and Martina, are they the two girls in one of the photographs? They're two girls with their backs to us sitting on two chairs.
I think those two girls now, they're from the Bell and Robe group.
Right.
Yeah. But,
keeping that hair and just the simple act of brushing it. I'm wondering even to what extent the ritual of brushing, I presume you brushing both Caitlin and Martina's hair at different points, maybe even them brushing yours, or sisters, mothers, grandmothers brushing each other's hair. How much of a ritual, how much of a tradition is that?
It vary, you know, on the age, I suppose, as well. Do you know, when it gets a certain age as well, it'd be great with, like, from my experience now, do you know, my two girls, like, they're two teenage girls, but they're great at looking after their own hair. Very talented with the hair, with the upstyles, with the plaits, you know, and they can do, like, the fishtail plaits. Like, they can do them themselves. They'd nearly do a better job than what I do, and they're great with the upstyles, even putting in curlers. You know, they're great, but to an extent to that, I would have looked after their hair very, very well, you know, say it until they got to, you know, I would have been doing a lot of it till they'd be, say, 11, 12. But when they got to that age, then, you know, they wash it themselves, brush it themselves, plait it, you know, they keep the plaits in for the tidiness, say, at night. You know, it thickens the hair, keeping the hair plaited. But they love their hair, and I have to say I love my own hair myself.
Let me go back to Breida at this stage, Annie, and I'll come back to you again in a few minutes.
Lovely.
The idea of putting the exhibition online, was that as a direct result of the situation we find ourselves in now, Breida?
Well, no, it wasn't. That was a plan. I always wanted a website, and originally I thought of a publication. So for this round, we you know, this is kind of first stepping stone in this project, and I thought a website would reach a lot of people. So also, I just want to say I'm very grateful for funding from Creative Ireland for this project and for support from Mayo Arts Service. They've been great. So, we planned, I worked with the photographer Orla Sloyne. Annie mentioned her there, and she's based in Mayo also. And we did a good few, sessions in different locations, tried lots of different lighting, different situations and atmospheres. It was really interesting. It was great fun. Like, we all had great fun as well with the girls and the women. Annie mentioned as well there that we worked in Ballinrobe and Maple Youth Centre. So that picture you're talking about with the two girls which sitting on the chairs, that was one of the first photographs we took. I love that photo, you know, because it's so, it's such an interesting photo because the girls are obviously in their normal everyday clothes, you know, of this very contemporary of this day. But you see this beautiful hair, long hair, which is something like kind of pretty ancient about it, you know. So when we then kind of brought all the photographs together, we had this great kind of job of curating them for the website. So there's four galleries on the website, and really they're just to so that you can move through them in kind of in a mood way through the photographs.
Breida, Annie, you mentioned plaits there as well, and you mentioned the doing of different styles of plaits. There is a tradition around the plait on the death of a woman. What is that?
There would be a tradition, like some people would have the tradition if a loved one passed away, you know, they'd cut the plait and they'd put it into the coffin. You know, some people would do that now, like, you know.
And are there superstitions around her as well?
There would be, yeah. You'd have various ones. You know, there would have been a lot more so years ago, you know, with the older people and that. You'd have a lot now, even to this day now, that kind of put a red ribbon on their hair, whereas no one would kind of overlook it, you know. Because it'd be their crown and glory.
Yeah.
They'd think an awful lot of their hair, do you know. It's their pride and joy, really, do you know. And I suppose they just feel a bit of protection on that, you know.
And finally, would you pick up a comb now if you found one on the road, or would you believe in that particular superstition, Annie?
I'll tell you, I wouldn't pick up a comb off the road anyway. do you know? Because do you know, it wouldn't be a really smart thing to do now, like, you know.
Certainly not at the moment.
Yeah, not at the moment, no.
But I do believe that the superstition there is that it could belong to the banshee, and she might come looking for her comb.
That would have been more now, I'd say, of the older right. generation years ago, like, you know.
Fair enough.
Sure, look at the times we're in now. Sure, there's not many, even anybody that would pick anything up off the road or off the ground, you know.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. And finally, Breedy, then, this is an ongoing collaboration. Yes. There'll be more of this.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And as you can hear from Annie, we had a lot of fun actually just in the workshops and talking about customs and traditions. But we do have future plans. I mean, there is an exhibition scheduled in the National Museum of Ireland in Turlough Park for October. So, you know, we're not sure how that's going to go ahead, but it'll happen in one way or another. And yeah, like this is a kind of period, and I'm using it as a research period, just to research other areas, you know, and other subjects that came up while we were talking about hair. Hopefully we'll be, I look forward to getting together again.
Absolutely. Sounds like good fun. That's Annie Lawrence and Breedy Mayock there speaking to you about the exhibition Crown, Hair and Identity in Traveller Culture. It's online now at crowncloseup.ie. Not many new TV series have a pedigree as striking as Netflix's 8-episode The Eddie, which begins streaming this coming Friday, based on a set of jazz songs from music producer and songwriter Glenn Ballard. It's executive produced by Damien Chazelle, director of La La Land, and all of the episodes are written or co-written by Jack Thorne, the man behind Skins and His Dark Materials. But does the series live up to the promise of those big names might suggest? Aoife Barry has watched The Eddie and she joins us now. Sounds like a bit of a concept series, a series of a set of jazz songs that are going to form the basis for a television series, Aoife.
Yeah, and that's essentially where it started, like back in 2013, so like 7 years ago. The executive producer, Alan Poole, met up with Glenn Ballard, and Glenn Ballard had basically written a number of jazz songs and assembled a band to perform the songs. And that was the beginning of it, this idea of this club called The Eddie and working this series around the songs. So eventually they got Jack Thorne on board, who you mentioned there, who people know from Skins and This Is England. He's a scriptwriter, and he started writing the story. So they gave him this kind of album of songs and they said go away and write about the story of the Eddie, and he wrote about these people and this band. It's basically a struggling nightclub, and the band are real musicians, so you're not seeing people pretending to play piano, pretending to play the drums. You're seeing real people, and then you follow them along through this 8-part miniseries, but you also follow what's happening to Andre Holland, who plays Elliot, one of the co-owners of the Eddie, and the kind of the stuff that he gets mixed up in, which is a little bit darker than jazz music.
Produced, as you said, by Damien Chazelle, who directs the first two episodes, you know, this being the Oscar-winning Damien Chazelle, yeah. La La Land, Whiplash, First Man. I suppose if you're looking for somebody who can direct and produce music, films or television series, he might be the man to go for.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's one of these kind of wunderkinds. Like, he's only in his mid-30s, and he straight away, you know, with Whiplash, his debut feature, people were raving about it with really good reason. It's such a really frenetic, energetic film. And he's somebody who studied jazz drumming when he was younger. He's half French. This film is set in Paris. He knows what he's talking about with the music. And he also has a really distinctive style, which he, you know, he can kind of change up depending on whether it's like La La Land he's doing that film or whether it's Whiplash. But with this, he directs the first two episodes, and he really gets into the kind of it being France, the cinema verite style. It's all handheld camera work. You really feel like you're in the venue, in the Eddie with the band. You feel like you're on stage or in the crowd, or you're like in the dressing room while they're having these difficult conversations. So he's a really good name to have attached to it. But there are other directors on it too as well. Huda Benyamina, Laila Marcheschi and Alan Poole are all involved as well. So it's not just Damien Chazelle's baby.
Yeah, and obviously music is a huge part of it. We see performances, but we also see music being composed literally in front of our eyes or in front of our ears. And this first clip that I want to play gives us a sense of how that is done. The character of Maya, she's kind of Elliot's on-off girlfriend. Elliot, Andre Holland, has brought her, is working on a new song with her, and it helps to relieve the tension after Elliot criticised her performance the previous night.
What's burning inside? A yearning the night just gets stronger. Here's where we dare to strip it all bare. Sit with your truth, dark corner bow. Sleeping slow in the strong and the top. Daddy.
Wish you sung like that last night.
There you go. Andre Holland as Elliot and Joanna Kulig, she's a Polish actor, playing the part of Maya there. That gives us a sense, Aoife Barry, I don't know how many of the episodes you've watched, but it gives us a sense of the pace and the tone of this series. They're in no hurry to do anything at all. I mean, that's a good, a good minute-long clip where they're literally noodling around in a kind of a jazzy type of way. There's a fair bit of that style, isn't there?
There really is throughout the whole series, even though you know little touches differ depending on the director, but essentially like this whole series is kind of like a, you know, inspired by jazz in terms of it's a little bit of improvisation. It kind of goes in its own direction. You don't have necessarily this one central plot point that you're following all the time. You have to weave in and out of things, and that means as well sometimes you're watching a musical drama, so you actually are watching songs, the entirety of a song, and all the songs in this were recorded live on the set where they created the club. So you're getting real live great jazz music by brilliant musicians, but they spend a lot of time concentrating on that. So whereas in other series you might get a short clip of the intro or the outro, you get the entire song here. And like, I really did appreciate that because it showed that the people making it are really into the music and the songs are really good. But it does mean that you sometimes feel it's a little long, you know, you have over an hour for the first two episodes, which is a little bit self-indulgent, people might say, and people might get a little bit, you know, antsy waiting for things to happen. But I found that the more episodes I watched and the more I kind of leaned into it, the more you really feel the kind of gritty Parisian suburb where they are. You feel like, you know, the torture that that Elliot Udo was under with the various things that are going on in his life. And then you have this beautiful music to listen to too. So it does bring a lot of elements together that can sometimes make you wait for things to happen, and other times you really kind of get into the vibe of what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I watched the first two episodes and kind of towards the end of the second episode I was thinking, oh yeah, I do want to watch more of it now. I didn't feel that at the end of episode one. I thought, oh, get on with it. This is an hour and 6 or 7 minutes. But the cinema verite style is vitally important in all of this. You've talked about the gritty side of Parisian life that we see in it. How well is that represented?
Now, obviously, I'm not a Parisian, but it seemed to me like a really good kind of depiction of what I've seen, I suppose, when on my trips over there, which I won't be doing anytime soon. But yeah, it really gets under the skin of the fact that like this isn't your classic Paris. This isn't the center of Paris, the tourist areas. This is a real, you know, living, breathing part of the city, a part of the suburb. You have tower blocks where teenagers are hanging out. You have, you know, the city streets. You have your little cafes. But you also have a really strong sense of the multiculturalism of Paris. In fact, the entire series is done through multiple languages, chiefly French and English. So sometimes the two characters that are speaking, or three or four, will be, you know, interchangeably going in between different languages. You've got people of different religions. There's a Muslim funeral takes place or burial takes place. You know, you get the sense of like, this is Paris. It's not just, you know, white people living here. It's people of all different backgrounds. And you also get the sense of, you know, the jazz history of African-Americans moving over at the start of the 20th century to Paris to create new lives there and to create a massive jazz scene there too. That's talked about as well. And so you get that history coming through it as well.
Yeah, and I suppose important to say about the language, I don't think this was just the way I had my subtitles set, but some of it is translated. The French is translated into English for you, and even the English is subtitled because some of it is quite heavily accented. But there are other languages there. Arabic is spoken at certain times. There's an Eastern European language. There's Polish spoken at another time as well. They're not translated. Yeah. We're left in the dark, which is part of the plan.
Yeah, which is interesting. One of the characters called Jude in it is from Cuba. He's a double bass player. He's a really great character in it. And when he speaks, they just say speaks in Spanish underneath it. So you know, which I found was like, come here, give Jude a chance because his storyline is great. You do follow different characters in each episode. You follow specific people, even though it's kind of interwoven between with some other themes. But so that way you get to know the different players too and the different languages and the different nationalities that they represent.
Yeah, an important part of the story here too is the father and daughter tale between Elliot and his daughter, and let's listen to a clip that gives us a sense of that. Andre Holland again here, he's talking to his daughter. Amanda Stenberg is the actor involved, about why he can't leave Paris and go back to New York.
Why don't you want to come home?
I used to play at home sometimes, and then your brother would sometimes come into the room, do this little stiff man dance. When he was 400 years old, he wouldn't move his arms, legs. He just kind of... That used to make your mother laugh. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard you talk about Fred in a really long time.
New York isn't my home anymore.
Yeah, but it's my home.
That's Amanda Stenberg and Andre Holland there in a clip from The Eddie, which is the new Netflix series. And Aoife, that story goes on, the story between the father and daughter, the on-off relationship with the Maya character, that goes on. There's a touch of a police procedural and a murder mystery going on here as well.
Yeah.
There's a drug scheme within, or a drug deal within it. There's the cross-cultural relationship possibly between two of the characters. There's an awful lot going on. Is there too much?
There is an awful lot going on. And personally, I found that the police procedural side of it, you know, that was a bit that I felt could have been left to the side. I mean, I know they say, you know, when you're writing a series, when you're writing about characters, you want to put your character in hot water and see how they react. But I don't think they necessarily had to put Elliot in the middle of a police procedural. It kind of distracted from the real life sense that you got from the rest of it. I mean, Amanda Stenberg is so good as his daughter, Julie. They're just such a great pair together. You know, she just plays this idea of this troubled teenager, which could be quite cliched. She actually plays it in such a lovely, realistic way. You can really feel her wanting to lash out at the world around her. That's the stuff that I really connect with a lot more than the police procedural, which is a little bit like Spiral, the French series. There's a touch of that to it there, but I don't think they needed that necessarily.
Yeah. And each episode focuses on a different character. I've only watched Elliot and the daughter, Julie, and each one then brings you off in different directions. Would you recommend going for all eight, but to give yourself a bit of time and stick with it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I just dived in and watched as many episodes as I could in one go. And I think that really helped because I do think that these days our attention spans can be a little bit short and this series really makes you work. But when you get into it, it's really, really enjoyable. Even any of the cliched bits, you can kind of forgive because you do get a lot of great music and you get really good acting in it as well.
All right, that's Aoife Barry speaking to us there about The Eddie, which will be on Netflix from this Friday. On the 3rd of May 1808, Napoleonic troops took revenge on Spanish rebels who had risen up against the invading army the previous day in the uprising of the 2nd of May. Before dawn on May the 3rd, the rebels were rounded up and shot. Many years later, the great Spanish artist Francisco de Goya commemorated these two events, the rising and the reprisal, in two paintings, one of which, the 3rd of May, has become the iconic image of revolution. The man with the luminous white shirt, his hands above his head, facing the French firing squad with his compatriots' bodies strewn on the ground. To look at these works by Goya and other works that could be said to be inspired by times of revolution, I'm joined this evening by Jessica Fahey and Sarah Wilson. Jessica, the Goya work, first of all, I suppose we're talking really and truly about the time of revolution when we think particularly of the French and American revolutions, which would have been around that time. What makes the Goya painting so iconic?
Hi, Sean. Yes, essentially, Goya is positioned within the history of art as being the last of the great old masters and the first of the modern masters. And really, it's down to paintings like the Third of May that give him such a position. So on one hand, he's using, you know, traditional elements of chiaroscuro, so very light, very dark areas of the canvas to make it very dramatic. But on the other hand, he's approaching the subject from a much more individualist, subjective point of view, something that we associate with then the sort of growth of romantic ideas or romanticism into the 19th century. So rather than show a scene of soldiers or of war as this glorious epic event, he actually shows it as this supreme tragedy and this sort of brutal, inhumane, unnecessary massacre of these everyday ordinary people who are shown very much unprotected against this elite firing squad that we have in front of them. So it stood for an example of a painting that is not showing the glory of war, but showing the reality of war.
And is he also playing around with what would have been the classical rules of painting? He's not following those necessarily in this.
Exactly. So as I say, there's still some things that, of course, would be similar to old masters, but he's painting in this very loose, almost sort of messy looking way, which would be very different to the kind of highly finished style that we would have in neoclassical art, which is the period that still sort of exists in and around this time as well. So it's like this is transitionary almost. And this loose freedom of the brushstroke gives a sense of a kind of emotional, almost expressionism feeling, but also this sense of immediacy, as if this is something really happening to us.
Yeah.
And because he painted it only 6 years after the event, it is something that he could have witnessed. Now, I'm pretty sure he didn't, but he could have witnessed. So playing around with style in that way is definitely something that he does. But even in terms of the black background, so no sort of sense of the sky yet, we're given some sense of perspective. He is playing with the traditional academic rules to create something much more emotive and emotionally moving, essentially.
And even in the thumbnail print I have looking at online, the white shirt stands out so much. The 3rd of May then, Jessica, that continued, that painting, 3rd of May 1808, continued to be incredibly influential, not least of which was the first manifestation or an early manifestation of that influence in Edouard Manet's painting, The Execution of Emperor Maximilian of Mexico.
Absolutely. So this is really fascinating because, of course, the enemy in Goya's painting are the French army, whereas technically the enemy in Manet's painting, which very, very closely follows the composition of Goya's, is technically the Mexican army. But they are presented dressed quite similar to the French. And not only that, one of the figures reloading his rifle may well be a portrait of Emperor Napoleon III. So it's quite a political piece. The story actually was that after French involvement in Mexico, they left behind Emperor Maximilian with the idea that he would keep control when he is sort of usurped and the Mexican revolt happens. He's left to be executed and no help from the French, essentially. So Manet, of this period, painting this work, is making a political comment. Mm. And one of the really fascinating things about it is that in the foreground, we have a sort of human-shaped shadow, which is technically being cast by us, the viewer, which is Manet making a point of how we are complicit in this tragedy, which is a very modern take on what Goya was doing.
And the Goya painting, I suppose, most famously in this country, picked up on the formation of it, or the way it's set out by Robert Balla in his 3rd of May after Goya, which was a painting he made in 1970, Robert Balla.
That's right. And it's in the Hugh Lane collection. He has taken away elements of the sort of naturalism of Goya's work and turned it into a pop art piece where it's about block colour and very thick uniform outline. So where in Goya's we feel the presence of the painter through the kind of visible brushwork, Balla tries to actually erase that. But in doing so, makes it a more accessible, popular image. And of course, And of course, the comment, you know, similar to Goya, is these the idea of sort of invaders coming onto the land of, in his interpretation of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and this idea of an army massacring the people. So it's very, very politicised. And again, in response to a current event, which arguably you could say the same for Goya. So Goya's image being able to be reused and recycled by various different artists. In fact, even later, Picasso, well, earlier than Bala, Picasso turns to it as well in response to a massacre in Korea. So there's lots of evidence of his influence continuing for a long time.
Let's go to Sarah now, to Sarah Wilson. And I suppose that end, that period in time, Sarah, the end of the 18th century, real time of revolution, the American Revolution, the French Revolution. And the French Revolution, of course, led into the Terror, a time of great bloodletting. And one of the revolutionary leaders, Marat, also ended up dying very dramatically. His death became the subject of the artist, one of the great artists of the time, Jacques-Louis David.
It did, yes. This is really one of the most iconic images of the French Revolution. And very interestingly, David is most famous for his classically inspired work, such as The Oath of the Horatii. But he was actually a very active supporter of the revolutionaries. And he was asked to produce three images that would immortalise three revolutionary martyrs, one of which was Marat. Marat was a publisher of a revolutionary newspaper, so he was a really key figure in helping to disseminate revolutionary ideas and rally people to the cause. The work itself is very much a contemporary subject matter, and this marks a very important shift in how artists are working. They're not just looking at history, religion, or mythology. They're now turning to contemporary subjects for inspiration, and not only depicting them, but also offering a commentary on them. So what David shows us is a few moments after Marat has been murdered in his bathtub. He apparently suffered from a very disfiguring skin disease, and to ease his discomfort, he would sit in the bath for long periods of time, even working there, so sort of setting up a little 18th century office for himself. He was stabbed by the royalist Charlotte Corday, who gained access to him through a note that promised details of a counter-revolutionary ring. So what David is showing us is Marat slumped in his bathtub, holding Charlotte's note in his left hand, sort of indicating her duplicitous nature. And then we can see the knife that she uses to stab him abandoned on the floor. Much like Goya, the background in this is very stark. There's no heavenly angels mourning the body. There's no lavish Rococo interior. This is a very bare, Spartan environment that's reflecting the ideals and the ideology of the revolution. And we can actually notice that David has included other symbolic revolutionary details. As I mentioned, he supposedly had this defigurating skin disease, but we see no evidence of that. He has this perfect porcelain skin. He's been very much idealised. And the pose that Marat is in was very much influenced by images of the Pieta. So what David is doing is positioning Marat as a martyr of the revolution and the new world order that the revolutionaries were due to bring in. And with a really interesting detail on the bottom right half of the painting, you can see this very rough, bare wooden crate that Marat has been using as a desk. And facing the viewer, you can see the inscription, the dedication to Marat. Below that is David's signature, and then below that again in French, we see year two. So indicating that we are 2 years into the new world after the French Revolution has begun.
So the David painting, quite definitely we're dealing with the French Revolution there. But Jessica, and I think a lot of people will make this mistake about Eugène Delacroix, a painting that's often thought of being associated with the French Revolution, but it's not. Maybe describe the painting to us first of all and tell us what we're dealing with here.
Yes. Okay. So Delacroix's painting, Liberty Leading the People, is an incredibly famous image where there is an allegorical figure of liberty who's depicted as a bare-breasted woman holding above her head the tricolour flag as she leads people on in battle, essentially. And as they're walking through the rubble or charging through the rubble, they're also then walking over dead bodies. So it's kind of similar to the foreground of Goya as well, where we see the dead bodies. So this is often mistaken to be a painting in referring to the first French Revolution, if you like. But actually, during the 19th century, it was a case of many revolutions, and this one was known as the July Revolution of 1830. So it only lasted a few days, but what they managed to do was to knock down another monarch, Charles X, in order to replace him with, again, another monarch. And this is kind of common. You see the same sort of trajectory throughout the 19th century in France, that it's constant change and constant revolution. So this particular revolution led to the July monarchy, which lasts for about 18 years. And the new king was Louis-Philippe of Orléans, and he actually purchased this work from Delacroix as a way of sort of saying that he was on the side of the people who were rebelling, and that this was going to be the democracy and the liberty that they wanted. But within a few years of his owning this painting, it was given back to the artist. It was seen as being a little bit too dangerous and too likely to set off another revolution.
And the Delacroix painting, ironically enough, is another image that was used by Robert Ballet to make a very contemporary statement, I think.
Absolutely. And interestingly, because Sarah was just mentioning David, he also used David as another, you know, very well-known artwork to turn into pop art, to kind of create that idea that of history repeating itself, but also to place into a current context, you know, something like the Troubles in Northern Ireland as being part of this ongoing history of liberation and freedom and revolution. So he really was very clever in his choices of paintings in that regard. And again, simplified into the pop art form, more poster-like, and painted in acrylic rather than oil. So, you know, the kind of modern take, essentially.
Let's come back to you then, Sarah, about, we've kind of skipped over the American Revolution there. Does it have an equivalent type of iconic image as we might have had in the case of the French Revolution and the David painting?
Absolutely. The image that a lot of people will be familiar with is Emmanuel Leutze's Washington crossing the Delaware from about 1851. And it's this very iconic image that numerous copies have been created of. And quite interestingly, Leutze is a German-born artist who was brought to America as a child. And then he subsequently painted Washington crossing the Delaware while he was living in Dusseldorf. It's a very monumental work that depicts this turning point in the American Revolution. So in about 1776, the colonial cause was not going very well. So George Washington decided to cross the Delaware River and attack a group of British forces under the cover of night. And his subsequent victory provided this very much needed sense of hope for the colonial cause. So what we're looking at is the moment where the colonial forces set out in a number of boats and they cross this ice-filled Delaware River. And we can see Washington in the lead boat, and he's this fantastic figure who's standing in this very heroic pose, looking intently towards the opposite shore. His face is lifted up to catch the early morning light. But I think of what is of real particular interest are the other figures in the boat, because the boat is filled with a variety of people designed to show the all-inclusive nature of the colonial cause. So it's actually a lovely piece of propaganda. You have three rowers at the front of the boat who are an African-American man, a Scotsman, and a frontier man. Then in the middle of the boat, we can see a couple of farmers wearing broad-brimmed hats. At the back, there's a Native American who's identifiable by his moccasins, his pants and his hat. And then very interestingly, in the middle of the boat, we see another very androgynous looking rower wearing a red shirt. And it's possible that this is actually a woman who dressed up in men's clothing in order to fight. What I suppose is important to remember about this work is that it is painted nearly 90 years after the event took place. So a number of artistic liberties have been taken to create an atmosphere of noble heroicism. The most obvious one being the fact that the event actually took place at night, but Leutze is showing it to us at the break of dawn.
Okay. Let me just finish up by asking you both to choose something, I suppose, a little bit closer to home. You know, you had three that you wanted to speak about. Kathleen Fox, The Arrest, Grace Plunkett, Gifford, one of the Gifford sisters, and the Jack B. Yeats painting. Choose one of them for me, if you would, Jessica, as particularly relevant in terms of the portrayal of revolution in Ireland.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll sort of briefly mention all three. I can easily bring them together because Kathleen sure. Fox and Grace Gifford studied at the Dublin Metropolitan School at the same time. And Kathleen Fox happened to be walking through Dublin in 1916 to witness the arrest of Countess Markievicz outside the Royal College of Surgeons, a painting which she then, when she finished it, had to send it to America so that she wouldn't get in trouble. Grace Gifford was very good at getting in trouble and actually was known to be quite a rebellious figure, although actually Fox had the nickname of the Little Rebel. But Grace Gifford ends up in Kilmainham jail as being on the anti-treaty side in the Civil War in Ireland. And she's famous, of course, for marrying Joseph Plunkett the night before his execution. But one of the things that's really fascinating about her as an artist is that most of her works are purely humorous. So there's fantastic works of cartoons that she published in 1919 that I really recommend people looking up because she had a great sense of humour. Even in jail, she writes to William Orpin, her old teacher, and asks him to send her sweets, cigarettes and roller skates. But while in prison, she paints this extraordinary Virgin and Child, which is a very moving piece.
Yeah.
And then the third one is Yeats, women, the women standing outside Kilmainham shouting up at the other women in the jail. And it's a really interesting piece of kind of reportage and sort of he distorts part of the reality of what Kilmainham jail actually looked like to sort of position these women as if they're damsels in distress up in the tower.
Okay.
And unusually for Jack Yeats, it's quite politicised. So there's the three in 2 seconds left.
Yeah. Finally from you, and briefly, you have to give me it briefly this time, Sarah.
No worries.
Picked Sean Keating, an allegory.
Yes, and I think that the title really kind of sums it up. This is very much an allegory for Keating's disillusionment with the use of violence after the Irish Civil War. And it shows four groups of disparate people who are together but very unaware of each other. You've got a priest and a politician who are kind of in cahoots on the left-hand side. In the centre, you have this wonderful large tree that has a self-portrait of Keating himself leaning back against, showing his sort of bitter disillusionment with the whole process. We have a young woman sitting on a chair with a baby wrapped in a white shawl. Some people think that the baby might be a reference to innocence, new hope, new life. Other people view the whiteness of the shroud as a death shroud. And then probably the most powerful part of the painting on the far right, where you have two soldiers, one regular, one irregular, working in opposite directions, but they're both achieving the same goal, which is to dig a grave for Ireland, symbolised by the tricolour covered coffin in the background.
That's Sarah Wilson and Jessica Fahey there talking to me about various works of art made in times of revolution.
Some would say stranded, but it's not how we planned it. Everything telling me I can't quit and I can't understand it. So we'll see through these hard times to lead to me. We belong in this deep blue sea. We belong in this deep blue sea.
Deep Blue there from Mango and Mathman. That track, of course, featuring the voice of Lisa Hannigan. It's from their current album, Casual Work. And later tonight, you can watch Mango and Mathman taking part in Other Voices, Courage, which comes from Whelan's in Dublin. You can watch the performance live at 8 p.m. this evening via YouTube, Facebook Live and RTE.ie. Just coming up to 10 minutes to 8 on Monday Night's Arena. When we think of grunge, the musical phenomenon that emerged from the Seattle scene of the late 1980s, the huge names roll off the tongue are Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden and so on. But one name that's not so universally recognised is that of Mark Lanegan, who many at the time tipped to achieve the type of superstardom we associate with those previously mentioned household names. Lanegan was a close friend of Kurt Cobain, an acclaimed singer and musician in his own right. He's just released his memoir, Sing Backwards and Weep, which details his early brush with fame and subsequent descent into alcoholism, drug abuse and homelessness. Tony Clayton Lee has been reading the book for us and he joins me now. I mean, we should say, Tony, first of all, Mark Lanegan, he's been dubbed rock and roll's great survivor. New album coming out, which we will be reviewing on Friday's programme, in fact. But his starting, his early life, I was reading the first part of this memoir, it's absolutely harrowing stuff.
Oh, it is really scary, Sean, I have to say. And it's I suppose it's testament to kind of several things that he is still around. Number one could be, and I'm theorising here, could be his cast iron constitution of a Celtic descent. He's kind of Irish, Scottish and Welsh blood. So there is that. That's a kind of spurious theory, of course. But I think more than anything else, he was just, or has been, lucky. Really, really lucky, because you mentioned Nirvana's Kurt Cobain there in your intro. He was also particularly close friends with Chris Cornell, lead singer erstwhile of Soundgarden, who also passed over the last 4 or 5 years. So there are people that he has been acquainted with and friendly with along the way, and they're no longer around. But as you say, Lanigan still is.
Did music prove to be a kind of a rescue mechanism, if you like, from his early childhood difficulties?
There's no question about that. I mean, I think it's something that music therapists or psychologists wouldn't need to even, whisper. It's a kind of common fact that, so many people's lives are changed by art, effectively. And that is the case with Lanigan. Initially, when he was an early teenager, he gravitated towards the kind of classic punk rock sounds of, Sex Pistols, Clash, Jam, Buzzcocks, all of that kind of stuff. But as he got older, his forays into visiting local record shops made him much more aware of the quieter side, but no less disaffected notion of songwriting. And here I'm thinking of the likes of Nick Drake, Tim Harden, Tim Buckley, many, many others, Leonard Cohen, people, songwriters who would express their dissatisfaction and I suppose their emotional internal decay to a degree in far quieter terms. And I think the combination of the kind of loudness and viscerality of punk rock and the sensitive stroke expressive of what we would regard as singer-songwriters kind of fused, particularly in his solo work.
Well, he worked with a band before the solo work came along, with a band called Screaming Trees, and they had a 1992 album called Sweet Oblivion. Let's listen to the lead single off that album, a song called Nearly Lost You. It's a song called Nearly Lost You there from Screaming Trees, and that from their 1992 album Sweet Oblivion. Tony Clayton Lee is with me this evening. He's speaking about Mark Lanigan of Screaming Trees and Mark Lanigan of Mark Lanigan, solo artist who's just published his memoir Sing Backwards and Weep. That memoir title, Tony, I think gives a sense of the tone of this. How much is it just one series? Like, even Screaming Trees didn't make it possibly as big as they could have done. Mark Lanigan possibly didn't make it as big as he could have done. Is everything just one missed opportunity after another, which can be a bit wearing to read?
Well, you are correct, certainly, in the first part. It was certainly one missed opportunity after another. But I think the architect of those missed opportunities, and indeed particularly of Screaming Trees' misfortune, was Lanigan himself. I mean, he certainly was not, during his teens and 20s and perhaps even coming into his 30s, the most reliable person you would want to hang a kind of music career on. There are numerous occasions where the band Screaming Trees were, just on the cusp of something. I mean, so we've listened to one of their tracks. They're a good band. They had some very good songs. And but nonetheless, through Lanigan's misdemeanors and personal kind of problems, excuse me, and personal problems, they just didn't kind of get off the ground. Similarly, sorry, Sean, go on.
I was going to say, does he actually put his hands up and take responsibility for that in this new memoir?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, firstly, it's written very, very well. It's very sparse. It's very lean. The prose is very good. It's very affecting. It's very emotional. He does put his hand up, but it's not all woe is me. I mean, there are other factors involved. I think more potently, his own family background, which, as you said at the very beginning, was extremely dysfunctional. But he's one of those people, a survivor for sure, he's one of those people that has managed by some shape or some trick of the light to have positioned himself, so certainly over the last 20 years, as one of those singular, very, very different kind of songwriters. His style now, from his solo years for sure, is very far removed from his kind of grunge days. It's very, very quiet, very intense. If you want a kind of joyful music, then perhaps he isn't the best person to listen to. But if you're a fan, certainly, of those singer-songwriters that we mentioned about 10 minutes ago, with a kind of contemporary twist that also kind of like twists the knife in, then Lanigan is your man.
Does he give us a number of details or a number of accounts, I believe, in the book of his various run-ins with Liam Gallagher?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit OTT, I have to say, but it's very, very funny. He devotes about, I'd say, the guts of 4 or 5 pages to a kind of early run-in with Liam Gallagher. When Gallagher was in Oasis, Mark was in Screaming Trees, they kind of toured together in America. It obviously did not go well for either of them. People who have been scrolling through their Twitter feeds over the last couple of days would have seen Liam tweeting about Mark and Mark tweeting about Liam. And while it's all a little bit two guys squaring up to each other like school kids in a playground, it is amusing. That said, it doesn't take away for a second from the fact that Lanigan's book is a tough document. He's a tough guy. Clearly, and it's a wiry book. It's written in a very terse, kind of almost kind of noir fashion, and there is a sense of humour throughout. So he kind of comes across very well. It isn't all woe is me. He isn't a sentimental person. What happened. He absolutely screwed up his life and the lives of other people to a degree, but he is, I suppose, unrequited in his lack of sentimentality about things.
And Courtney Love comes out of it okay. He talks about how basically she funded his successful rehab.
Yeah, I mean, that is another very, very nice twist in this really riveting memoir. He went into rehab in the mid-90s. She funded much of it, and he lives once again to tell a tale, and hopefully he'll be telling a few more tales in years to come.
All right, so you clearly enjoyed it. That's Tony Clayton Lee there speaking to us about the memoir Sing Backwards and Weep from Mark Lanigan. It's published by White Rabbit and Orion, and as I said, we'll be reviewing Mark Lanigan's new album on Friday night's programme. But that's our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.